KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. We're heading into the last official month of summer. August is often a time for vacations, maybe even a road trip. Coming up, we'd like to hear about your worst road trip experience. And this is the important part, the lesson you learned from that horrible experience. Email us now, weekday@kuow.org. Over the past three decades, routine cancer screening has become common and widespread in the U.S., and that has led to many more early cancer detections, but it's also led to overdiagnosis and overtreatment of conditions that aren't serious enough to warrant that treatment. That's the takeaway from a commentary published in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week. It was written by a working group of the National Cancer Institute. The group also recommends changing the definitions of some diseases that are currently called cancer. Dr. Laura Esserman is director of the Breast Care Center at the University of California, San Francisco. She was lead author of the journal article. I asked her what that term overdiagnosis means.
The term overdiagnosis means that these are the kinds of lesions that if you left them alone and didn't do anything about them, they wouldn't ever come to clinical attention. So, you know, I think the issue is for the public and for many physicians have the concept that we had of cancer when we started a lot of these screening programs, and you know we had the observation that people who have early stage disease have much better outcomes than the people of late stage disease. And since we assume that if you have early-stage disease, you will necessarily progress to late-stage disease, we could really make a huge dent in cancer mortality and the consequences of cancer by simply finding it early. And so we have really heavily pushed the concept of early detection. But it turns out that the story is more complicated than that. It turns out there are lots of different kinds of cancers, and that the biology is often predetermined. Some are very slow-growing and progressive. Some are rapidly growing, aggressive, and progressive. But some are slow-growing and won't necessarily progress or may even go away. And I don't think that we understood that really at the time. And the more you screen, the more you're going to find some of those ones that wouldn't go away. You know, I mean, that would have gone away.
Right.
And so that's... And so it just turns out that, you know, the more you screen, the more you're going to find of that. That's a consequence of screening. So people have to be aware that our notion that we've learned more, and so that we know that that's going to be a consequence. Now, we're not perfect at telling the difference, but we're getting better and better, and I think that the more we recognize it's a serious problem, the more we're really going to do what we need to do to solve it.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anyway,
I was just thinking that the advice isn't to stop the screening. The advice is to talk about what you find in a different way.
Right, and to make it to try and maintain the things that are good about screening while minimizing some of the harms. And there's a lot, and you know, as you know, we thought about, you know, this brainstorming group we had, we really feel like we came up with some good suggestions to really make it better.
Now, aside from breast cancer, which is clearly is your specialty, what other kinds of cancers fall into this overdiagnosed group?
Well, just about every cancer that you screen for intensively, you know, for example, even colon cancer or cervical cancer, you find many, many more polyps than ever become cancer. But we don't take people's colons out because we find a benign polyp.
Mm-hmm.
And the cervical neoplasia, some of the endometrial lesions, if you look, you're going to find more and more of these. Even the lung cancer screening group, when they, the recommendations just came out from the U.S. Preventive Task Force guidelines, they said to be careful that 20 to 25% of the cancers that might be found from screening, you know, will not be the killer cancers. So one of the things, there are some molecular tools that help you tell the difference, but we have to start figuring it out. And they also gave the information that just because you have a little nodule on your CT scan, you shouldn't necessarily go after it. The lesions that are between 4 and 6 millimeters, there's only a 0.5% chance that that's going to be cancer. So we have to have more courage in leaving things alone, or at the very least saying, you know what, we really don't think this is anything, truly, and the public needs to believe it because there's no urgency, and let them go because there are consequences to all these biopsies. And we don't want to over-treat people. So we have to give people permission to start, you know, safely doing less. It's very important.
You talk about consequences. Are there, in addition to the emotional consequences of being told that you have cancer, are there physical consequences from over-treatment itself?
Sure. If you, you know, if you wind up having, you know, I think that, you know, we, you know, in ductal carcinoma in situ, for example, you know, that also is a condition that comes in many different types. But there's some that are on the low side, and a lot of people get very frightened by it and think about doing mastectomy, or we do a lot of mastectomies. We do mastectomies, we do lumpectomy and radiation. I think we need to start, especially for these lower-grade lesions, start watching more of these and finding out, are these really serious? Or we're taking a different approach. There's some clinical trials that you can participate in to try and doing things differently because it's not clear that we're benefiting. These things are physically difficult and emotionally difficult. Having your prostate out and having the consequences of a big surgery or having impotence if you don't need it. You know, people understand the issue in prostate cancer, but it takes some courage to do things differently. And maybe one of the ways to do that is to work harder to reclassify these conditions at the low end of the spectrum and not call them cancer. And I think people would be less afraid to watch and wait.
Is there opposition among your fellow physicians to reclassifying or using a new terminology for some of these early lesions?
I would have to say that I've gotten a lot of correspondence from a lot of my colleagues welcoming this kind of change and asking either to participate in it or the head of the Dermatology Society, Mitch Goldman, actually made a comment that, you know, he thinks it's really important in the field of melanoma and some of the what people are calling precancerous lesions, and feels that we really need to ratchet down the terminology so people don't get frightened or don't do extra procedures or feel that they're waiting for the other shoe to drop.
How far off is really precise science that would help you guys determine what kind of lesion might grow more quickly than another type of lesion?
Well, I think there's a lot of places where we can start to do that right now. And I think in the next 5 years, if people really put their mind to it and they really pay attention to it, I think that we can make huge progress. But, you know, it has to be made a priority. And I think the way you make it a priority is to make sure that people understand that it's in their interest. It's a really interesting and important scientific topic. And it's one where we can come up with better diagnostic tests. You know, but people have to be willing to believe it. And we're not, you know, people need to know that their life is not on the line if they either take a little bit additional time. Remember, the cancer is not an emergency, and certainly there's no urgency to take out a condition if you, like in ductal carcinoma in situ of the breast, where, you know, we're worried about progression over a 10-year period. You certainly don't have to make a decision to go to the operating room in 2 weeks.
So the takeaway for people who are listening right now is to continue the early screening, but to then talk to your doctor about what stage you're at.
Well, it's not even just what stage you're at. If someone recommends that you have a biopsy for breast cancer or for prostate cancer, you know, you should ask first, you know, do I really need this biopsy? Is it urgent that I do it now? Can I watch and wait? Is there any harm to waiting to see if something more serious develops? Because we can tell if someone's really at risk, high risk for having an invasive cancer. We can tell that. And the part that's really hard is there's a lot of little things that we see that may turn out to be nothing. And, you know, waiting 6 months or a year is not going to put anybody's life on the line, so you can ask questions and say, maybe I don't need that. And if you have a precancerous lesion, you should say, is that really precancerous? Do I have to do something now? Is there a clinical trial I can participate in? And the same thing, you know, with early prostate cancers. And the same thing for lung cancer screening, don't do these vigorous screening programs unless you focus it really on people at high risk who will likely benefit. And then don't get biopsies for small little lesions. You know, the lung biopsies can drop somebody's lung and be, you know, have very serious consequences. So there's a roadmap there to be much more judicious about what we go after. And we don't have to know what every little thing is. Our diagnostic tests are very good and find all kinds of things. We, as a community, have to develop better thresholds that are, where we don't have to find out what everything is. We just really have to go after the things that are going to make a material difference.
Dr. Laura Esserman is director of the Breast Care Center at the University of California, San Francisco. She was lead author of an article published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association that says widespread early cancer screening has led to overdiagnosis and overtreatment in some cases. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Stories of terrible road trips and the lessons learned in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Zoo Tunes, presenting Todd Snyder's Traveling Folk Show featuring Sean Mullins, Hayes Carl, and Sarah Giroux on August 11th. Tickets, complete show calendar, and more at zoo.org/zootunes.
58 degrees in Seattle and cloudy. Looks like the clouds are going to stick around today with a chance of showers and an afternoon high of 71. I'm Bernard Ouellette. An investigation of lady detectives in the golden age of radio in 20 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. We have all had them, you know, those horrible road trips where the past-made plans just fall apart. With a little bit of hindsight, you realize there are always lessons buried underneath what seems to be permanent agony. We want your stories of bad road trips and the lessons you learned from them. Our number, 206-543-5869. So here's my story. In 1979, I set out from Ithaca, New York with a friend bound for Seattle. We were in my mother's old Volvo. It was one of the little ones that looked kind of space age. And we took the Trans-Canada Highway, which was fantastic. But about the time we hit Saskatchewan, we developed an oil leak, 1 quart every 100 miles or so. It was great. We bought a case of 1040 oil, and we'd stop when we both needed to snap a photo and add some oil, and we changed who did what. And believe it or not, we made it all the way across the Canadian Rockies this way. Things were wonderful, and then we rolled into Kamloops. It was a hot day. We pulled into the gas station. I jumped out to open the hood to add the oil, and imagine my surprise when I found flames. The engine was on fire, burning up the oil that had splattered on its casing. I'm not sure what normal people do in that situation, but I closed the hood, locked the car, and we headed across the street for ice cream. An hour later, the flames were extinguished. A mechanic, very kind guy, had plugged the oil leak, and we had to go to Vancouver quickly, where the nearest Volvo dealer would deal with our problem. Lesson: when trouble strikes, take a break to clear your mind and eat some ice cream before you make any rash decisions. Another lesson I learned: I really prefer not to deal with cars if I don't have to. What about you? You can email us weekday@kuow.org or 206-543-5869. Katie Sewell.
Yes, I have had many a lesson learned on a road trip, but the one I thought to share today, I was on a road trip driving along. I was the driver. And for some reason, as I'm heading down the road, I start to feel sort of lightheaded. And I think, oh, you know, I'm fine. Just shake it. Shake your head. You know, I was doing this. Shake your head. Keep driving. Keep driving. Then my arms started going slightly numb.
Oh, no.
My lips started going numb. And I just kept going. I'm like, oh, it's great. Finally, I got to the point where I thought, I don't think I'm going to maintain consciousness if I don't pull this car over. So I pulled the car over really quickly off the side of the highway, jumped out of the car, started walking into a field, trying to catch my breath, and just collapsed.
Oh, no. You were poisoned.
Turned out, after regaining myself and refilling the lips on my face, I opened the hood of the car and found that somebody had filled up the oil with and had not replaced the cap. And the oil smell was flowing into the vents on a hot day, straight up my nose and making me about to pass out. The lesson I learned from this was, of course, if you feel weird, stop the car, Or, that could translate into life. If one of your arms isn't working, go see a doctor.
There you go.
Stop putting it off.
Don't put it off. We have been shouting out for the last couple of days to listeners, and here's what some of you had to say.
One, two, three, four.
A few years back, we went to Cleveland for my mother-in-law's 90th birthday. Another family member made a reservation at an economical motel. We checked in. A rail thin young man, I noticed that he had one very long fingernail. And he said, if you don't find the room satisfactory, let me know and I can refund your money. Thought that was odd. We go to the room. There was sort of black pepper along all the floorboards. Turns out it was fleas. My daughters begin screaming. One runs out to gack in the garbage can. Well, we weren't going to stay there. So, turns out the Ku Klux Klan and a motorcycle convention were in Cleveland at the very same time. They had taken all the hotel rooms. We had to drive 30 miles to another hotel, but we do get a place to stay.
Life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road.
I bet the lesson that she learned is make a reservation ahead of time when you're on the road. What are your road trips from hell and the lessons you've learned? Carla in Darrington says, hello, I grew up in northern Michigan. When I was 18 or 19, I took a road trip with two girlfriends to Toronto. We got there fine. We had a great time. From there, we headed to Niagara Falls. When packing the car to leave, I noticed my emergency brake light was on, even though the brake wasn't set. I fooled with it a bit, then decided the light was broken and took off. Not far down the road, my car started smoking. I knew immediately the e-brake had seized. I pulled off the freeway into the first available spot, a bus depot. A driver came up yelling, saying we couldn't be there. I burst into tears, burbling out what had happened. His whole demeanor changed. She said, it's okay, gave us directions to a nearby shop. I got my brakes fixed and we were on our way. It's funny now, although it wasn't then, the lesson. The worst things often make pretty good stories later on, and a nearly hysterical, crying teenage girl is apparently a pretty scary thing. We'd love your stories, 206-543-5869. You can call toll-free 1-800-289-5869. Helena in Bellevue, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. I wanted to tell you a story about our vacation I had when I was much younger. My mom took off with four kids and for a vacation to Nag's Head, North Carolina, from Stamford, Connecticut. And she had been up really late packing the car and all our things the night before. And on the way down, she fell asleep and the car crashed into a number of guardrails on the side of the road, pushing in the metal along the fender of the car, rubbing the tire. We got that fixed, and we took off again, and I noticed my sister coming from the back seat, putting the steering wheel back into the lane. We were veering off the highway.
Oh, no.
Time. So this time, my mom pulled over and took a nap.
Good idea.
Yeah, but this time, at this point, there was no cell phones, and we arrived late at our destination, and they'd given away our house that we were renting. But they found a second place for us to stay, and when we walked in, my little sister threw up on the first bed that we came to. And my mother went to open the window to air out the room, and her hand went right through the glass because there was an Air Force base nearby, and they were doing a lot of testing, and there was a lot of sonic booms.
Oh, no.
And then my older sister started whining and complaining. She was very upset because the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan that night, and the new house they'd given us had no TV. And so the lesson I learned from this is to rest up before you leave and pull over when you're tired.
Ooh, just like Katie Sewell. So this is it. Don't push yourself.
Don't push yourself, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. And obviously, you all made it through alive and well. So we're glad to hear that.
We did. We did. My dad flew down to join us afterwards. And I did wind up having to go home with an ear infection early from this trip because of swimming in a pool. But it's a very,
And now you can tell
it. Memory after all, yeah.
And now you can tell the story. You live to tell the tale. Helena, thanks for joining us. What odd trips. Maybe it wasn't a road trip, but those are always full of great car problems. But a trip that you took from hell, a vacation trip from hell, and the lesson that you learned. Jess says, taking a bicycle road trip through Ireland with my sister during a summer from high school seemed like a good idea. We bought some cheap bikes and loaded up our overstuffed packs with camping supplies. Still, we might have made it with our stubborn sense of humor if not for the wind. The rain seemed like an afterthought when you're pedaling downhill, and the lesson that we learned, don't bike southwest against a strong northeast wind, and Craw-Patrick has the best spring water in the world. Happy travels. We'd love for you to call. I can keep reading these. These are great. They're long. 206-543-5869. 1-800-289-5869. Dan in Gig Harbor. A vacation story? Dan?
Hello.
Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. I understand it's hard to hear me, but let's see. My story was years ago when I was down in southern Utah. I was with a friend camping in a national park there, and we headed out, and we had some car trouble. So we ended up rolling into a small town, thought we were out of gas, but we weren't out of gas, and couldn't figure out what was wrong. Ended up in a small bar where there was, it was New Year's Day, so there was just a bunch of people there for the day drinking, trying to figure out what was wrong with the car. And in the meantime, I noticed, or my friend noticed, that he had these tracks going up the veins in his arms.
Ooh.
And he had blood poisoning.
Oh, no.
Of some sort. Because he was a mechanic, and somehow he'd gotten blood poisoning. And so we had to get him to a hospital, and we were trying to talk somebody in the bar to get him into the nearest town, which was miles away. And nobody wanted to leave. Nobody wanted to take him. And so he was starting to, feel pretty sick, and finally some guy offered to take him. The guy was really, really drunk, so he got taken to the nearest hospital, which was, about an hour away. And in the meantime, I worked on fixing the car, and we found out it was, something with the rotor. And anyway, it took us all day, and we finally got it straightened out. My buddy was okay, and we were able to get out of there, but it was a crazy day.
Did you learn anything from that experience, Dan?
Well, I think I learned that, one, I should have had some tools with me and probably some extra parts because the car was a very old car. It was like a 55 Studebaker.
So it's sort of be prepared is the motto, I think, of that trip. Glad that you made it through to tell the tale. That was Dan in Gig Harbor. We go to Madison Park where Ann is on the line. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my story happened just a few years ago, about 4 years ago. I had a large road trip, camping trip planned with my 7-year-old daughter. So we decided to do a practice trip first, which was going to be just a 2-day trip to Orcas Island.
Mm-hmm.
So we went there to camp, and I had my 7-year-old daughter and our 4-year-old dog. The second day of the trip, I started getting stomach pain, and I often have stomach problems, so I wasn't too concerned. But as the day went by, my pain became worse and worse, and I was sort of paralyzed. I didn't know what to do because I had a dog and a 7-year-old in a tent, so I couldn't leave them and go somewhere, nor could I take a dog and ride with me to what to do. So I just kept hoping it would get better. Well, about 5 o'clock in the evening, I realized it wasn't going to get better, and there was no way I could go through a whole night like this. So I went to the campground's office and asked them if they could tell me where the hospital was, the nearest hospital on Orcas Island. But there is no hospital on Orcas Island.
Oh.
So they called they called the paramedics who came and said to me, we're going to have to airlift you to Bellingham. And by this point, my seven-year-old is hysterical. And I'm explaining to them, I have no one to leave my daughter with. I have a dog. I have a campground. What, you know, I can't do this. And they said, you need to go. This is really serious. So I ended up getting airlifted to Bellingham, leaving my daughter with and the dog with the paramedics.
Oh, no.
They found another another paramedic who lived on a farm. She came. She had six children. She came, took my daughter and the dog and my car. They went to my campsite, packed up the entire campsite for me, kept them overnight until a friend of mine could fly up the next day and drive them home.
So
it was a horrendous, you know, it started off just being this very traumatic experience for my daughter, but she ended up staying on a farm, meeting a baby pygmy goat, some lambs. My dog made friends with the baby goat, and it turned into a great adventure for her. And the lesson was that, you know, there are just some amazing people in the world.
Yeah.
And when you need them, they step up.
The kindness of strangers. That was a great lesson for your daughter.
Yes, it was, because it was terrifying in the beginning, but she came out like a hero, and she had made new friends, and she had helped my dog, and even had the farmer's wife look at my dog because he had a sore on his foot, and she got that taken care of too, and it was actually really empowering for her.
Wow. Well, I'm glad there's always a silver lining. Thanks for sharing that story, and you sound like you're okay now, so that's good to hear as well.
Totally fine. Yes, thanks very
much. Great. Bye-bye. We are talking about your worst road trip experience and what you learned from it, and that's quite a lesson. We go to Tacoma, where Enrique joins us. Hi, Enrique.
Hi. Thanks for having the call.
So your story?
Yes. Yeah, so we drove from Tacoma to Idaho last summer. No air conditioning in the car.
Ooh.
We had some sand belt problems, had to pull over, get some repairs done. It was about 100 degrees, and I had a 9 and a 6-year-old, my kids in the back seat, and they were quite fussy. The only thing we could think of was to take all of the cold beer cans out and shove them in their armpits and between their legs. And when they got warm, we'd shove more cold beer cans in there until we got to where we were going.
And what did you learn from this great beer can healthcare experience?
Probably that kids not suffering from heat stroke is more important than cold beer.
I love that one. And I'm sure the beer manufacturer, if you wrote them, would be thrilled to know that there are many uses for beers. Thanks for sharing your story. Appreciate it. You can cool off with a cold beer in more ways than one. Your road trip stories, maybe you're just setting out and you're going to learn some great lessons from our listeners today. 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Patrick in Green Lake, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay, well, my story is actually when I was a kid. We were taking a fishing trip. And we're on our way back, and there weren't really enough seats in the car. So my friend and I parked the back of the truck. And we had these clear ponchos that we had used for vans. And it was a long way. It was raining. It was cold. So we just kind of wrapped ourselves up and pulled the strings tight and fell asleep in the back of the car. I wake up about an hour later, and we're pulled over on the side of the road in a parking lot. And there are about 12 different state troopers surrounding our car. The cops have hopped out. They have guns pointed at us. People are freaking out. And I pop my head out of the poncho to see a sheriff right next to the truck. And apparently, my dad had been driving through town, and the cops had gotten a bunch of calls about two kids who my father had killed that were wrapped in plastic in the back of the truck.
Ooh. Ooh. They thought you were dead.
Exactly. They thought that apparently, my dad was, mafia of some sort, going to dump us in the river.
So what did you guys learn from that?
I would say... keep in mind how you look and what your appearances are and how other people might perceive them.
Yeah, or you'll be woken up by a sheriff thinking that you're a corpse. Thanks for sharing that story, Patrick. We get this email from Mary. The trip in 1977 was wonderful overall, but it started out as a challenge. My friend Patty, who'd majored in medieval history, and I flew to Paris, where I'd rented a car for our trip to Normandy, Brittany, and the Chateaus of the Loire. Unbeknownst to us, it was a national holiday of some kind, and the car rental desk in the airport was closed, of all things. We finally managed to rent from another company and headed out of the urban area. Our plan was to stay in Rouen, where Joan of Arc was martyred. Again, to our surprise, all accommodations there were totally booked, as we learned after multiple phone calls. I majored in French, but the jet lag was intense after the long flight and the visit to an important medieval site. When we had to give up on staying in Rouen, Patty commented we could always sleep in the car, a small Renault. I burst into tears. This was not how we planned to travel. A kind person took pity on us and suggested a country pub miles away, where we found one room with one bed above a garage. Patty and I are good friends, but we're not that close. But we fell into that single bed and we fell asleep instantly. And from there on, the lesson we learned was to make reservations earlier in the day, like the best boy or girl scout. Be prepared. Happy travels to all of you planning road trips in this month of August. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Okay, from road trips, next we're going to take another kind of trip, a trip in the old time machine, to learn about the female detectives of the golden age of radio. That's just a minute away. Stick around. -59 degrees in Seattle, expecting the clouds to stay with us through the day, maybe bringing us some showers, and we're expecting a high today of 71.
Last year, a white supremacist opened fire inside a Sikh temple near Milwaukee. The massacre led the Sikh community to search for answers, and for some Sikhs, to embrace their identity.
No matter how different anybody looks, we're just as much of a human being, and in America, we're just as American as anyone else.
A Sikh community recovers today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Bedrooms and More, family-owned in Wallingford on Northeast 45th Street for over 30 years, providing a selection of two-sided flippable mattresses designed for lasting comfort. Learn more about flippable mattresses at bedroomsandmore.com.
-10:39, I'm Bernard Ouellette. The recovering economy is creating more jobs at the bottom than it is in the middle. This week across the country, a lot of fast food workers are staging walkouts to demand better pay. Is $15 an hour a living wage, and is it realistic in the fast food economy? That's 30 minutes away.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
From road trips, we cast our thoughts back to the golden age of radio. Katie Sewell in the studio with me. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Marcy.
Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here. Well, as you know, during the golden age of radio, it was detective shows, one of the most popular genres of the day. Detective horror comedy. That was pretty much what we were dealing with most of the time. But the way that women were portrayed in these detective shows wasn't always the most flattering portrayal, at least by a modern audience standard. I thought we could start this discussion by listening to some of the stereotypes.
Okay.
So many shows had the sweet but very ditzy secretary. And I'm going to play you my favorite one. This is Effie from Box 13.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes I get worried about you, Mr. Holliday.
Sometimes?
Most times. It's just like a nomination.
Oh? What am I running for?
Huh?
Nothing. I just had a premonition.
What's that?
What you didn't have.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all right.
Effie is a classic.
Yes.
Then there are the criminal girls, and, of course, they're innocent victims.
Do you like anything you've seen so far?
Well, this next piece isn't bad, but I want something more expensive.
You don't need to wait. I'll let you know if I find anything.
Oh, that's quite all right. I have nothing else to do.
How nice. I'll tell you what I'd really like. When I was coming in the store this afternoon, I saw just the neck piece I wanted in the left-hand main window. Do you suppose you could get it for me?
Oh, I'm sorry, madam, but I'm not supposed to leave the department.
But that's exactly what I want. Oh, won't you please see if I can take a look at it?
Well, as you can see, madam, there's no other girl here to watch the stock.
Couldn't you make an exception just this one?
I'm sorry, madam. Isn't there something here that would suit you as well?
You're a smart girl, aren't you? Too smart for your own good this time.
How do you mean, madam?
Just this? Oh!
I was waiting for her to pull out a gun. Bang, bang.
Use your fists if it's more convenient.
Oh.
I wanted to find a clip for you to listen to of one of these thug-type women ordering a pink lady in a bar. Hey, give me a pink lady, because they do that all... There's so many shows where they
wow.
do that. And it happens frequently enough where I decided to go into a bar and order one of those one time. Terrible drink.
Okay.
Never order that.
All right. I will not, because then I'd be a criminal lady
in a golden age
radio show. Okay.
So when it came to actually solving crime during radio's golden age, that was a male's job most of the time. There were at least 120 different radio shows that were about male detectives. And by comparison, over the entire golden age, there were only about 44 shows that start a female character, which is actually more than I was expecting.
I didn't think there were any. So
but they didn't necessarily last very long in their runs. So most of those shows are completely forgotten today. So for fun, I thought we'd take a listen back to a few of the female crime fighters that exist on the airwaves. Let's start with the very first one, shall we?
Philco Mysteries on the air, bringing you Phil Cole, the famous girl detective, and another opportunity to win your share of the $50,000 in cash prizes to be awarded the winners in this thrilling contest of skill.
This is Skill trying to think up a new name for Phil Coe.
Yeah, Phil Coe is her name. That's short for Phyllis Coe. She's named after the show's sponsor, of course, Philco Radio Tubes.
Very creative.
Yes, that show went on the air in 1936, and as you heard from that announcement, the listeners could get in on a weekly jackpot of $50,000 in prizes if they could solve the crime. Now, here's how it worked. During the show, Detective Phil Coe would lay out the questions and also lay out the puzzle.
Mrs. Brown, whom we came to visit, is in room X, and Mr. Oliver is directly across from her in room double X. And in room Y, across from Z...
You wouldn't be interested in that room, Miss Coe. It's empty.
I'll go in and have a look anyway. I'll be right out.
So then the listeners were called upon to solve the crime, and this is how they ended every single show.
Why do you suppose Phil Cole, the girl detective, suspected Harry Jewett? He really trapped himself, you know. Do you know why? With the help of your Philco Mystery Book number 2, it should be easy for you to answer the contest question. So go and get yours free right away from your Philco Radio Tube dealer.
It always does come down to a commercial, doesn't it?
It does, but I was thinking this is early listener participation.
Yeah.
Very nice.
And it actually sounds like it would be pretty fun.
It does.
I was thinking I wish somebody would do this today. So for those of you who are creative out there. Moving on. Let's move on to the very second female detective who ever appeared on the radio.
Procter & Gamble, the makers of Dress, present Kitty Keene.
It's kind of hard to hear, but that's the opening to Kitty Keene.
Uh-huh.
She made her appearance in 1937, and the show was actually not a detective show. It was a soap opera, but it was the only soap opera that had a private eye in the leading role. Kitty Keene was also the only grandmother in the history of radio that solved crime.
Kitty was supposed to be a grandmother.
She was a grandmother.
Wow.
Of course, part of the soap opera was her daughter had a baby and she became a grandmother. Of course, the show was also to emphasize that she's not only crime-fighting grandmother, she's beautiful too. So
You have to be pretty.
Very important. Let's listen to another female gumshoe. This is from a show called Meet Miss Sherlock.
Now
what, Peter?
Will you marry me now? Tonight.
Oh, Peter, I'm so sorry. I can't tonight. Tonight I have to solve the case of a dead man's chest.
Oh.
What a pity. Tonight you have to solve the case of the dead man's chest.
I can't go with you.
This show aired in 1946, and Miss Sherlock was supposed to solve crimes like Sherlock Holmes. But you can hear from that clip she's a little bit ditzy in her tone.
I've not heard of this show before.
No. This show was a summer filler show, which meant it played while a more popular show was on vacation. And since I could barely find a single thing that was written about it, And I could only find two episodes online of the entire run. I'm guessing it didn't last very long.
Okay. Well, it seems like the fate of a lot of these shows.
Yes. And I searched very hard for clips from a show that was in 1946, a show called Police Woman, which, from what I read, is supposed to be one of the more serious of the female crime-fighting dramas. Mm-hmm. It followed the life of Lieutenant Mary Sullivan at the New York City Police Department. And there was also a West Coast version of the show that was called Police Woman USA.
But you couldn't find anything?
Couldn't find them anywhere.
Oh, no.
I looked all over the place. So if anybody has Police Woman, also hard to research based on its name.
Yes.
Try typing in Police Woman on Google, right?
Yep.
Feel free to send that on. So as I've mentioned, though, that most of these female detective shows are hard to find, except for one of them.
I'm glad one is present.
Yes. This female detective is the one that really survived all the years of history between the Golden Age and now.
Hello, Yukon 28209. Yes, this is Candy Matson.
Yes, Candy Matson. She's probably the most remembered female detective from the Golden Age. And it's probably because she was really flirty and she was very daring.
Well, Mallard, my favorite foot flap. You caught me at the wrong time.
Depends on your viewpoint. Shall I leave?
No, come on in. What brings you up to Telegraph Hill, Mallard, dear?
You.
An interesting subject. Care for a drink?
No, I'm on duty.
You mean I'm being honored with an official call?
Sort of.
In that case, you can leave.
No, seriously, Candy. You can help me if you will.
Well, the mountain coming to the mountain.
Oh, you're not so large.
Now you can leave.
Only kidding.
Yes, she is never afraid in any dangerous situation, which is interesting. Interesting. It's also set in San Francisco, which is kind of an anomaly. Monty Masters was the one that created this show. He originally planned the show would have a male lead,
right?
Because that was typical, after all. But at the urging of his mother-in-law, he rewrote the show and cast his wife, Natalie Parks Masters, as the lead.
So that's who we're hearing there.
Yes, and so perhaps her mother was looking out for her, wanting to be an actress. I'm not sure.
Good for her. So when was this on the air?
I think it was on the air from 1949 to 1951. So it's kind of at the end of the Golden Age, probably another reason why we still have a lot of copies of it. Personally, it's not one of my favorite shows. However, if you would like to listen to it, I did put a link on the website.
Okay.
You can listen to it. And it never attracted a sponsor the whole time it was on the air, which is pretty unusual, even though it claimed to be San Francisco's most popular radio program.
Okay.
Well, let's end with one more, shall we?
Yes.
One more radio memory of the few and far between female crime fighters.
Ladies and gentlemen, to depend upon your judgment and to fulfill mine own obligation, I submit the facts, fully aware of my responsibility to my client and to you as defense attorney.
Da-da-da-da. That's the show, The Defense Attorney, mm-hmm. which aired from 1951 to 1952, not too long of a run. The lead character, Martha Ellis Bryant, fought crime by swearing that she was going to defend the defenseless in court. So it's a little bit of a different angle.
She was a lawyer, like the Perry Mason of women.
She's a defense attorney.
Okay, there you go.
Hence the title. The title role was played by a woman named Mercedes McCambridge. And she was an actress that Orson Welles used to call the world's greatest living radio actress.
Wow. Well,
which is interesting because I haven't heard much from her.
Nope.
For those of you who are listening, heading down to Los Angeles this summer, you can remember the name Mercedes McCambridge because she does have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Well, that's great.
Yes. So she's remembered for TV. And for movies, she's not really remembered for her radio show, Defense Attorney. But, you know, that's not surprising, is it? Most of these shows are totally forgotten. Until today, of course, Marcy.
I'm glad, Katie Sewell, that you have resurrected them. And we look forward to taking a walk down the fond path of the golden age of radio again with you next Thursday.
My favorite path. I'll be here.
This is Weekday. little summer jazz music to make you at least wish for summer, because it's not quite there today. 60 degrees and cloudy, but weather forecasters say summer will be with us once again by the weekend. It's Thursday. Food writer Sarah Dickerman is with us, and she's here in the studio, which is such a nice treat for us.
So glad to be here.
And we had been enjoying all the warm weather that we were having, and so we thought we would talk about picnics. And so I think we still will talk about picnics, and people can just put this in the back of their minds for when the weather turns good again.
Well, you know, we remain ever hopeful here.
Yeah, it is true. It's all that you can do when you live in this part of the world, and we can't complain because at least it's moderate as opposed to 110 degrees.
Exactly, and you'll just be ready to act fast when you're ready for your picnic.
And part of the reason this picnic idea came to us, Sarah, was that you've been talking a lot over the past few weeks about various kinds of sandwiches or things that you want to take out. So we thought we would expand. Do you want to talk about what we can buy first or what we can make first?
Oh, let's talk about buying.
Okay.
Well, and one thing, I have a little article in this month's Bon Appetit, and I talked about picnics there and a little bit about all these wonderful little shops that don't have much seating.
Or if any.
And they're, you know, they're not always right next to a park, but one really fun thing to do is to go to one of these wonderful little shops. So Kedai Makan, which is a little Malaysian place, I mentioned it last year when they were just a food stand. Now they actually have a little walk-up window, and you can get this wonderful Malaysian food on Olive. And you'd probably have to hop in your car, and then you could go to either Volunteer Park or Cal Anderson and just really enjoy the food there.
I have friends that must have heard you, because somebody was recommending this to me for over the weekend. We can have a picnic dinner. There's this great Malaysian place. So picnics are not just for lunch. Picnics are good for every meal. But
anytime, but yes.
This is not open probably for breakfast, this particular one.
Oh, yeah, this one is not. This one's open in late afternoon. You'd have to have a late lunch if you really wanted to be lunch.
So picnic dinner.
Yeah. But Little Uncle, another one on Madison. Again, not much seating. Great Thai place on Madison. And that has actually, the new Bullet Center has a little park right in front of it. So you could even just go and dine in the shade there.
I guess you could. Or you might want to take your food a little ways further.
If you wanted a real, real full-on park experience.
So it's up at sort of the west end of Madison before you get to downtown,
as
opposed
to the hill.
Not down by Madison Park.
Right. And so those are a couple of ideas. Up in Finney Ridge, Picnic is always really reliable.
How appropriate.
It's well-named.
Now, Picnic is I think of it as sort of a store that you, I mean, it's it's not an épicerie is what they'd call it in France, mm-hmm. where you buy made foods of various types and ingredients.
Yeah, they make a good sandwich and they make great soup. So it's always worth checking out what they have. But I am a big fan of the specialty food store. And I think on a picnic, you don't necessarily need to have very carefully prepared foods. I sometimes just like to grab a whole bunch of things. And so I had a few other good suggestions for if you wanted to just get some wonderful cheese and a loaf of bread.
Yes, I want to hear those. That sounds good to me.
So also on Finney, and on Capitol Hill, is the Shop Agora, which specializes in Mediterranean imports of all kinds, especially Greek stuff.
I have been there. I think of that as a sort of olives and bread.
Right.
And maybe the pimento, little peppery things.
Right, so you could get a jar of pimentone, piquillo peppers.
Right.
And then what if you got, they have had burrata this week, which is like a kind of extra creamy version of mozzarella. It's kind of got a firmer skin on the outside, and then it's just really, really voluptuous and creamy inside.
It is delicious.
So if you had that and a loaf of bread, maybe a couple of peaches from the market.
Oh, that sounds good.
Very nice picnic.
So there's one on Finney and one on Capitol Hill, so you would have different destinations.
Yes, depending on where you're headed. But, of course, Woodland Park's right there if you're in the Finney one. Down closer to the market, of course, there's the Spanish Table and Paris Grocery, which are two of my favorite specialty stores.
And they are really, they have the same owner, don't they?
Mm-hmm, they do.
But but one is Spanish and one is French.
I guess they decided they couldn't mix the message. Although the Spanish is writ large, it's Latin American as well as Spanish. But should you want some delicious jamón serrano, some manchego, or like bleu de basque or something, it's some of their wonderful cheeses from the Basque region. Again, you could get your piquillo peppers. You can get great wine, which you may have to sneak depending on which park you're going.
That's true. Or you could take it home to your backyard.
Your backyard picnic. But that's a great place to gather ingredients too.
No, a French picnic is not that dissimilar from a Spanish picnic. I mean, you might get olives.
Mm-hmm.
You might not, jambon, it wouldn't be called jamón.
Exactly.
But are there anything that you would buy in one store and not the other that would distinguish them?
You might get different kinds of cheeses and different kinds of
but
olives.
But it's pretty much...
For the most part, very similar. You could get pâté, certainly. I can't remember if Paris Grocery might have some lovely salmon, like rillette or smoked salmon, something like that. Again, it's similar,
I'm trying
similar
to visualize.
Things, but they're right next to each other, so you could... feel free to mix genres.
And they're on Western, so you have to, if you approach the market from downtown Seattle side, from the mm-hmm. retail core side, you go down the hill.
Right.
And then you'll find these,
exactly,
these stores.
Exactly.
And so you could either walk back up or you could walk all the way down to the waterfront.
Right. Right.
And someday we'll have a wonderful waterfront park, right, that you're
yes.
going to eat this picnic at. Where else might you gather ingredients?
Another big place that I love, which isn't a scenic place itself, but if you were headed south or you already lived in south, is Big John's PFI.
Yes, not scenic at all. Big John's PFI is kind of behind a parking lot with a lot of potholes and gravel.
Sort of in the stadium area,
yeah.
Yes. And but that's some of the pleasure of it, because you really feel like you're going to the source when you go there. There's no landscaping for you inside, outside, or inside, really.
And they have everything there.
They have everything. Again, mostly a Mediterranean focus. It smells like a real import shop that I grew up with. I think it's, I haven't figured it out. I think it's some combination of olives and salt cod in the air. And it's a smell that just thrills me, because it just smells so good to me.
So in just the last minute, these are all things that you really don't have to worry about refrigeration immediately with. But if this was a concern of yours,
yeah.
How would you, very quickly, how would you store and carry this stuff out?
I love to get a portable tote, not a hard cooler, because I find them hard to carry, but you can get the soft kind. And I just, you know, whenever every now and then I get an Amazon Fresh order, I steal the little gel packs from that occasionally, put them in the freezer. And I think that's a really good, solid way. You can always include something frozen that's going to defrost over the day if you're going to have it in the car for a little longer. You know, something like a frozen chilled soup or something like that you could put in there, and that will help defrost, and then it'll be ready to eat later on in the day.
Well, okay, today might not be the best picnic day, but I'm assured by somebody that it's going to be better over the weekend, so we can cross our fingers for that. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, the New York Times. Her website, sarahdickerman.com. She's on Twitter, @SarahDickerman. And here on Thursdays, and you have made me quite hungry for a Mediterranean picnic, so thanks.
Let's hope for the sun soon.
We will hear from Nick Bond, our state climatologist, tomorrow when he joins us for his weekly visit. Also, our roundtable of journalists will be in our show. Oh, and Thierry Rotereau. He's going to be cooking from the fridge. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, Andy Hurst, Bernard Ouellette at the helm. I'm Marcy Silman. Food, glorious food, how we love it.
It's a minute before 11 o'clock. In the news today, the White House says it's extremely disappointed that Russia gave NSA leaker Edward Snowden asylum. We'll have more on that in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
News happens. It can be anywhere.
To dissolve the Constitution on a temporary basis.
On PRI's The World, we look for second opinions, unusual angles.
No, you cannot do that. This is democracy.
We help you think through the day's events.
You may see even more demonstrations down the road. This is only the beginning of Revolution 2.0.
PRI's The World. It's your world.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.